Welcome to episode 39 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
We're recording on July 2nd. And
2016.
And it's a...
Podcast 39.
39.
Oh, we said that.
Yeah.
So we're only a couple days late. But the website is really behind schedule and getting updates.
Yeah.
Like, I think we're 2 weeks behind.
I think we might be.
Yeah. but I will get a partial catch up this week. So, there's really not much. We're still using the old microphone it's our older one.
Yeah.
Frustrating, but still easier to use than the headsets. Should we jump it right in?
Sure.
Okay. I think we'll keep this one shorter.
Mm-hmm.
We have to pack still.
Right.
So, which is going to happen as soon as this is done.
Exactly.
Okay. So, do you want to go? Or?
So, one of mine is about Mars. And it looked at the sand. It was a very short article, and it said unique sand ripples found on Mars, and it's from June 30th in Science News. And basically, you know, when you go to a beach, you notice certain patterns as mm-hmm. the sand ripples in the wind,
which we're going to see the week after this.
I know, that's probably why it attracted me. Or you see dunes form, and in Mars, it's slightly different, where you have a slightly different pattern forming, and it's kind of cool because it has to do with the atmosphere and the density of the atmosphere causes the patterns to be slightly different, and it's just one of those cool findings that they have, that now that if they look back for ripple patterns in ancient rocks, they can see similar patterns that indicate changes in the atmosphere over time.
Cool.
Yeah. So very short, but it just caught my eye, probably because we're going to the beach.
I've done so little reading, and I have to say, this is another one that I wanted to read, and I never got to it.
Oh, that's fun.
So, yeah. Although I'm really excited to hear about your frigate bird one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I really wanted to look at. Do you want me to do one of mine?
Yeah. Or
I guess we should stick... We're doing space.
Yeah.
Space. Okay. So, science... June 17th issue, they had a news story about the LIGO project detecting a second gravitational wave event,
which
was very cool.
Yeah.
It was detected on December 26th.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's two black holes again. So the first one was not a fluke, which is very cool because, you know, you see it once and it's like, the first one was in September, I think. Let me see. Yeah, September. So September, October, November, December, like 3 months later.
Mm-hmm.
We have another one. So, I mean, this is going to keep happening, which is really cool. The other thing is, I think the first one, they only had just a few cycles that they recorded, and I don't know why. But this one, they have a full, like, 1 second, and it's 55 cycles they recorded.
Wow.
So even though I think, this one, the September one, the black holes were smaller, which is normal. I can't remember how many solar masses. The first one was really weird, and people are scratching their head because they're larger than the theory expects. Mm-hmm. For the sizes of black holes.
Right.
I don't know why. And they have a neat picture or diagram on page 1374 where it shows where the black hole came from, in, you know, across the night sky. And I don't understand exactly how they can tell. They have two detectors that they're using. So maybe it's from
one range of satellites compared to another.
Well, they're on Earth.
Well, I mean, sorry, dishes compared to another.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how you could tell it comes from one direction. If it hits one before the other, you know that it came from that direction. But how do you know the angle?
Right.
You know. Anyway.
So when you were telling me about this earlier in the week, I couldn't help thinking about, you know, early discovery of the cell.
Oh.
And the idea of what we thought a cell was.
Uh-huh.
And it was actually the technology and microscopes and the development of microscopes that allowed us to see more of the detail in cells.
Yep.
And that's what gives us, like, the idea of what a cell is today.
Yep.
And I was thinking, how cool. We're seeing this happen in our time,
but with
space.
Yeah.
And so I was like, this is really neat how our understanding is based on the availability of our technology to be able to see so that we can make better pictures of what we're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
you remember the story in the first one? We talked about it a lot in one of our podcasts, and it was just such an exciting story. And it had to do with them testing LIGO after a refitting. And I think it's going down again for a refitting again, and not to improve it anymore, just for something or other. But with the last refitting, they were saying in the article that there's a, what they call a design sensitivity, but they're not there yet. And so they're still increasing sensitivity.
Oh,
I don't
know
what it means to, you know, for them to put it down or not. And they said, maybe, I mean, they're not certain, but now they have two. They're saying in the article, it's possible that if they reach full sensitivity, that they'll be detecting, like, an event every day.
Wow.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
That would be pretty cool.
And one thing there's that is a problem they were saying is that they've encountered the sensitivity they are at now. They've encountered a low-frequency noise that they don't understand. So that's something they've got to solve. But, you know, even if they don't solve it, even if they don't get beyond this, if they're detecting something every 3 months.
That is pretty cool.
I mean, we don't have statistics yet, but there's 2 in 3 months.
Right.
The other thing is they're thinking they might detect collisions between other objects. And, for example, neutron stars. And I was thinking to myself, so why neutron stars? And what occurred to me is that, well, why do we detect black holes but not suns hitting each other? And it's because black holes have collapsed so far that by the time they merge, they've gotten very close to each other. But a sun or a star, it's got a certain mass, right? And it might be the same mass as two black holes, right?
Right.
Like two suns colliding. But two stars, that same mass, it's being pulled in by the gravity, but there's fusion that's pushing it out at the same time. So they're colliding at a much further, they're colliding when their centers are much further from each other. So the rate of change of the gravitational field will be much lower when they collide, and hence the waves will be smaller. And that's when I was thinking, well, a neutron star, that's just like, you don't get any denser. I think it was saying, you know, a lot of neutron stars are several times the mass of our sun, but it's just neutrons. Imagine the size of an atom's nucleus compared to the whole atom. I think that's what we're looking at in terms of a neutron star versus a real star of the same mass. And that's why, you know, when they finally collide, they've already gotten, the centers have gotten so close that the gravitational fields, the rate of change of it over distance must be huge. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting.
That is unique.
And there's another one coming online that's also getting refit, Virgo, which is in Italy, somewhere by Pisa. So, yeah.
Very nice.
So we're getting lots there. Anyway, that's it for LIGO.
Yeah.
Stay on
space
or move on.
I noticed one that you had.
I have another one.
With pies the in pie space?
One? Okay, I'll do that one. So this is more of an education one. Mm-hmm. And when I read it, I was like, oh, this is really about education more than anything.
Right.
But basically, there's a mission or a program, I don't know how to call it. I guess it's a mission. There's a mission called the Principia Mission. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the logistics and the organization of all this. So I'm just going to say what I did. I'm not going to talk about what exactly is a mission and what's the program. But basically, okay. There's an astronaut from the UK, Tim Peake, and he's part of this program in the UK that involves kids in school designing... writing code mm-hmm. for a Raspberry Pi with a particular shield on it that was
the sense hat
exactly mm-hmm. They chose out of a whole bunch of them, seven of them that they're going to send to the International Space Station, and this, by the way, it's out of the Linux Voice issue from, well, it's this last one, so that'd be July, I guess.
Right.
And it's on page 28. Anyway, so it's really cool. And the Linux Voice guys chose three of the seven and just looked at some of what they did. Mm-hmm. So one of them is called Watchdog.
Yeah.
And it's from the Cottenham Village College. And basically, they use all of the sensors on the sense hat to monitor what the environment is in the International Space Station.
Oh, nice.
And so this is like temperature, humidity, and pressure, that mm-hmm. type of stuff. And they compare it to what the design parameters are, and then they have an alarm if it goes outside
nice.
Of parameters. So it's a double check on whether everybody's safe and everything, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And the sense hat's pretty cool. I mean, they've packed all of what you'd think of sensors that would make sense, you know, temperature, humidity, pressure. There's accelerometer on there. There's magnetic field sensor. I think they can get vectors and including the vector magnitude for the magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
There's an LED matrix for getting output, and there's a joystick for input.
Yeah. It looks like a cool little device. It's nice and compact. Yeah. And
the really neat thing is that the kids can get them for themselves in school mm-hmm. and also, you know, for at home. So
right.
they could have exactly the same hardware that's going to be sent up to the International Space Station.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
See, I really like the fact that they had two that are the very same or more that's on the space station. So, you know, if they're problem solving, like, how come when I turned it on, it's not working?
Exactly.
You know, they can go back and figure out, well, you know, okay, so how'd you turn it on and you know, what happened at this stage when it stopped working? So I thought it was a neat way to double check their system. Very nice.
Anyway, so the other two projects they covered, one's called Flags,
mm-hmm.
and I guess that NORAD mm-hmm. sends out telemetry data for all sorts of satellites, mm-hmm. and you can get access to it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they get it through the internet. Oh, they said they get it without using the internet, so I don't exactly understand how that works. But that's fed into the Raspberry Pi for the International Space Station, and they have on board, on the Raspberry Pi, they've put in information about what countries that matches underneath, you know, for the latitude and longitude.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the LED matrix, they display a flag of whatever country you happen to be from.
Yes, I noticed that.
I thought that was fun.
I thought that was very cute.
Yeah, and then they scroll a little message in the language of the people.
Very nice.
Let's see, the last one's kind of cute. So it's called Spacecraft. Wait a second, the flags one. That was from the Thirsk School. And the last one, called Spacecraft, is from the Cumnor House Girls School.
Neat.
And so they do, this is again a sensor reporting project where they sense things in the spacecraft. And then I don't know what they've chosen precisely, but the way they do it is they have a Minecraft game and they program the Pi to have different things happen in the Minecraft game to show what's the sensor output is and it's controlled. Yeah, so I thought that was
fun. That sounds really cute. Yeah. So it's a visual that goes along with it.
Yeah, but so you can see, like, it's all about, it's not so much about the doing of the science up there, it's more about this really fantastic opportunity for kids to work really hard at this programming, because their stuff is going to end up on the International Space Station.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then they can see it working up there.
Neat.
I think that's really cool.
That is cool. Yeah. That's really neat.
And, you know, figuring out how to program Python on the Pi, and then you've got to work with all these libraries to make it do what you want.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And how, so you have to also understand how to do that, and you have to learn, in their case, this last one, how to get your Python program to make something happen in a Minecraft game,
mm-hmm.
which is a separate program running.
Right.
So I don't know exactly how that works, but yeah, so.
That is cool.
Very cool.
That's a challenging problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's nice.
Anyway, so that's my other space one. Let me see.
Do you want to keep on physics? Because we're kind of doing computers, physics, and space.
Oh, actually, I have another physics, sort of, but maybe
that's
you should go next.
Okay. So mine...
Are you going to do Frigate Bird?
No, I won't.
Okay.
I'll do a short one. This was... I started reading it, and then I realized, I think it's a book review.
Okay.
And it's from July 1st of 2016 in Science, so it's just a recent science.
Uh-huh.
And it's under ecology, and it's envisioning a different future. And basically, it's this ecologist, George Woodwell, and
is it in your notes? Let me see.
Yes, it's in the notes. So almost 60 years ago, he's the one that had the firsthand evidence of DDT.
Oh.
And then with him, we have...
Found it.
Did you get it?
Yep.
Then we have Rachel Carson. She writes about it and highlights DDT's effect on the wildlife, right?
Yep.
And so he just released another book, and his book is talking about how we have to rethink how we're organizing the environment. And it's not enough to treat the effect, but we have to think of systems of zero waste systems of industrialization where every product can be recycled or reused.
Yeah.
And although this is, you know, I read it and I was like, this is, you know, it's interesting in that. In his book, I guess he gives several steps for how to go about it more specifically. But, you know, it's one of those challenges to change a system that's in place.
Yeah.
He also, I really like his idea of having global commons.
Uh-huh.
So instead of having just commons in your community, your local community where you have common, you know, green space, you have global commons, and that thought of having a global commons and globally it's taken care of.
I think that's awesome, but
yeah.
The problem is in having nations agree.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like the Arctic. Everybody thought, you know, oh, this should be pristine and everything. And then now that we have global warming, it's like everybody's rushing in there to claim rights to drill for
oil.
Right,
to drill. And,
yeah. And it's like, yeah.
Right. So as I read that, I had this, you know, this ongoing conversation back and forth,
yeah.
You know, echoing a lot of what you're saying. But I did love it. You know, some of the ideas also, you know, part of our way to control the changes, the climate changes that are taking place,
yeah.
Is also to really promote reforesting of land and mm-hmm. growing yeah. population. Yeah. You have that constant pull, you know. So, anyway, very, you know, interesting, and it's important that we keep those conversations going, and I hope they go beyond yep. conversations.
Yep. I mean, definitely the idea of having a global commons, or like places in the world that are managed by international agreement,
mm-hmm.
is, even though it seems like it's not going to work, it's like the only thing that can ever work. There's mm-hmm. no right.
I right. Mean, right. A solution for a, you know, long lasting.
Yeah. Unless countries impact. Agree, it's, mm-hmm. someone's going to exploit those places.
Right.
So it's not just because it's going to be difficult. It still doesn't mean we have any choice about it. It's
right.
the way to go.
It would have to start with areas that people don't find are very important.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when I started to think, like, how would you implement this? What would be a good place to start? And well, you would want places that don't have any resources. That,
yeah.
You know.
You also have situations that are interesting.
Can agree on.
Yeah, you also have situations where the reason that there's exploitation is because there's a very narrow interest by only a few countries.
Right.
And everybody else is just against it. And I mean, I'm thinking specifically of the whaling industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Whales have really come back.
Yeah.
And there's still some that are in, that are really in trouble. And there's a few countries in the world that are still wanting to exploit that whole resource. But the pressure on them is really strong.
Mm-hmm.
To stop it. And there's lots of already agreements. And the reason they've been able to continue with exploitation is because, you know, with these loopholes having to do with, you know, doing scientific research and killing through that method when really it's just going to market. And
right.
But even in within those countries, there's a strong... They're strong groups that are fighting to have mm-hmm. that stopped. So it's, you know, it doesn't have to be just places in the world or issues where there's no value.
It's, right.
As long as most people in the world see it one way and the countries that see it another way have within them mm-hmm. groups that are fighting on the same side as everybody else, it's, you can make some headway that way.
Mm-hmm. It's and it's funny you thought of the oceans, because that was one thing that I thought of. I was like, well, maybe the oceans would be a good place to start.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking of whaling and the fish industry, and that being yeah. such a contention between different countries who,
yeah.
you know, are trying to develop different yeah. populations. Yeah, it's going to be a challenge, but very interesting. Okay, so you're next.
I'll give you a choice. I have a super short one about mental maps, or we could talk about Brexit. It's happened.
Yeah, that one just, I was blown away by the vote. I thought it would be close, but I did not think they would choose to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's been a lot in Nature, mm-hmm. and there's been a few articles in Science. The one that I found most interesting had to do with the whole ITER program. I mean,
wow.
This has been a disappointment in how it's been going. I was really thinking, you know, maybe this last, you know, couple years ago we were looking at ITER and they were like, she's going to change things and and maybe get things going, and it's been just very difficult. But the latest news is that the U.S. is probably going to stay in, even with all the problems, and at least for a few years. So we'll see what happens. But the Brexit issue, as far as ITER and fusion research is concerned, the article's from Science on June 17th, page 1376. And the point they're making is that there's a lot of international programs in Europe that, even with Brexit, they're going to go on because they're kind of outside control of the European Union. So CERN, you know.
Right.
I don't know if you ever thought, holy crap, what's going to happen with CERN? Actually, right. That's not controlled by the EU.
Right.
It's a separate thing. And there's a few others they mention in the article, but ITER is controlled by the EU. It's through their Atomic Energy Commission. I can't remember the name. And in the UK, there's JET, the Joint European Torus. And I think that gets a lot of its funds through the EU. And what's real... So I don't know if you remember, but I think it was a year or two ago, we were looking up on YouTube videos, the plasma. They put on videos of the plasma inside a tokamak, and I think it was inside JET. And you remember the pulsating purple and stuff?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was really cool. JET is the biggest tokamak in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
I didn't know.
Yeah. And in my mind, that's probably huge for ITER because the insides of JET have been remade with beryllium and something else. I can't remember what. And it's the same inside they're thinking of using in ITER.
Wow.
To withstand the high temperatures. So really, JET is going to tell us a lot about how to continue with the building of ITER and how it's going to react. And then, and they've done something with JET to try to maximize how high a temperature they can run inside of it, because specifically ITER is going to have to run at a much higher temperature. So to see what's going to happen and to try to make adjustments that make sense, they're going to try to run ITER that way.
Got it.
The last thing is, JET, as far as I understand, is the only tokamak that can run on a mixture of deuterium and tritium, which is going to be the final fuel for ITER. So they're running JET on just hydrogen, just deuterium, and just tritium. Well, that's the plan anyway. And then after they're finished with that, they're going to try to run it on the mixture just as with ITER. I mean, these are all really important things to test out at a lower level before you get ITER going. Anyway, so this, if that shuts down because of Brexit, I mean, it's hard to believe that they wouldn't try to find some solution to keep it running, but man, that would be just one more blow to ITER, and you know.
Right.
Who knows? ITER might just keep going, keep building itself slowly, and eventually get to its goal. So, anyway, it's worrisome. So.
Wow.
Even though I'm really disappointed with the ITER project, it's just still so exciting as a possibility.
Yeah, I agree. It is.
Anyway, they said they're going to keep running it until the end of 2018, I think, or until sometime in 2018. That's when their contract ends. So, okay. And I think there's been some talk of turning JET into like a fully international project, not connected to the EU. So then Japan and US and others would use that, and that would be a different way of going forward with it.
Right. So. Wow.
Anyway, so that's my little one aspect of the Brexit.
Okay.
What it means.
I'm sure we'll hear more about it. So what's expanding our minds?
Oh, so the other one? Yeah, mm-hmm. I really found this fascinating, but mm-hmm. I didn't review it just before our thing.
Okay,
so
got
I'm
it.
Going to just mention
briefly.
So it's a news piece out of Science, again, June 17th, and it's on from page 1378. And it's more like a perspective on an article that's in Science.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, we've known that there's cells in the brain, which have been called grid cells, that they're laid out like a map.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on where you are in your local area, different cells light up.
Oh, wow.
So it's a way for you to keep track of where you are and where things are, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, is this when you were talking about your going to your castle?
No, that's
your
a
dream castle.
I don't think so.
Okay.
That was something else. I don't know where I came across that.
Okay.
I just came across and underlined the ancient memory palace.
Palace
technique.
Memory palace. Sorry.
That must have jogged my memory about mm-hmm. it. And people to remember facts by arranging them in an imaginary structure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so I think this new research helps to explain why that technique works really well. But basically what they found that's new is that it looks like these grid cells
mm-hmm.
are also used to organize data that has no relationship whatsoever to a location, a geographical location, or location in space. And the way they did it is they gave silhouettes for people to look at, and I think they used MRI to see what was happening. And there were silhouettes of birds, and they could smoothly change the look of the bird by stretching its neck or stretching its legs
mm-hmm.
and having it look different ways. And they had people look at these different silhouettes, and that's, since I haven't looked at it again, I don't remember exactly what they were doing, but basically depending on the shape, different grid cells would light up. They were the same cells as would be used in the location mapping. So you could have a two-dimensional set of parameters like neck length versus leg length, which would make you look more like stork versus duck, I guess.
Right.
And organize it in a two-dimensional pattern in your brain on grid cells, the same ones you use for location X, Y in the world. Yeah. So it might be used for all sorts of stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is neat.
Anyway, so that was my grid cell one, and that is all I have except for our future plans and whatnot.
Okay. My last article is how frigate birds soar around the doldrums.
That's the one that I wanted to hear about so much from you, and I guarantee I'm going to read that one.
Okay, so it's pretty cool. Like, you know, these are birds that have been around forever. Columbus wrote about them uh-huh. on his voyage over to America. And he actually records some of their behavior, which is kind of fun. And so, you know, they're trying to figure out, like, just how far do these birds fly? And so they hooked these birds up. They outfitted them with solar-powered transmitters, data loggers that measure heart rate, wing beat frequency, acceleration, altitude, and GPS.
Holy
Isn't that
smokes.
Cool? And they set it up so it doesn't interfere with their flapping and that, you know. And they found that one individual, this is an adult, flew for 48 days straight over 420 kilometers.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like, we always knew these birds flew all over and that they didn't really land.
So do they do, they must do like, the albatrosses using the waves to, like soaring without flapping, just using the air.
So what they found is they used strategies to what hand gliders use. You know, people who do hand gliding. But before I go on, there was one juvenile even recorded. It was only 2.1 months old. Or no, it was a juvenile, sorry, excuse me. It was a juvenile, and it flew continuously for 2.1 months. And it stopped only briefly on a small island, but still flew almost continuously. Isn't that crazy?
More than 55,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
Greater than the Earth's. I don't know what you were saying before you started to say juvenile, but I was looking at your notes and I saw stayed aloft for 2.1 months and I just stopped hearing what you were saying. I'm like, what?
I know. Because when I started to, I was like, oh yeah, you know, they fly a lot. Blah, blah, blah. And then you start seeing the numbers. It's like, holy, I never knew. Anyway.
This might be have to be the title, even though I didn't read it. It might be have to be the namesake of this podcast.
So what they think they do is they use thermals and they use clouds, specifically cumulus clouds. And by those, they can determine lift areas. And like gliders, anyone that does hand gliding and that, they aim for those areas where they can depend on uplifts or thermal lifts.
Hmm.
So I thought it was really neat that, you know, here they are, and they're just very in tune to clouds and cloud formations.
Yeah, interesting.
For them to fly aloft for so long.
Do you remember being... years and years ago, there was a place called Derby Hill, and at the right season, you could go on the hill, and it
migration
just,
during hawk migration.
Yeah, and it was just
raptor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the patterns at which the patterns that the different birds use in
and the topography of the land.
Yeah, but I mean, there was something about it was like a bottleneck where many migratory routes, for some reason, get funneled into this one area.
Right.
And you just get tons of hawks. And you could see them from miles and miles away, just slowly circling up.
And coming towards,
and then suddenly...
Yeah.
You'd notice, I don't think I've ever seen one actually leave that circle, because they're always like dots. So,
right.
But then you realize there's a long line of dots going down from one final type of area.
One and thermal then lift to another.
Yeah, yeah, and then there's another, and it's like all of these hawks, but you have to really know what you're looking for.
Oh, yeah.
And then they pass right over the hill, and you can really see them.
Yeah, and we had a birder with us, like a specialist, and he as a speck in the sky, he could say, red tail. And now we have a
rod wing.
And he would recognize it so far out that you had a good amount of time to aim up your binoculars and see what it was.
And I remember the naturalist had numbers permanently set up around Derby Hill.
Yeah,
and he'd be like at number five or at number seven, and you'd get the azimuth that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not by a real azimuth, but by just where you'd look towards that number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. So the only other bird that flies as much or as long as the frigate bird are swifts. And swifts fly for long distances. So So
what about
one thing,
albatrosses? Because albatrosses must stay up forever.
I thought so too. They are not mentioned, but maybe I just didn't, I missed it. So here's the thing that they don't have information about is they don't have sleep wave patterns to tell when they sleep. Hmm. And that would be kind of interesting to see how they're getting the rest over these long flights.
Yeah.
But anyway, another thing that I thought was interesting is that, you know, around the doldrums, there's nothing. So that leaves them really at a loss for how to get around that. But all around it are trade winds, and the trade winds are pretty predictable.
Yeah.
Not only that, when you have trade winds, then you have more evaporation off the water. You have those nice cumulus clouds form. Hmm. So maybe there's a way for them to get around it and on the edges. But anyway.
Also, you figure if you go closer to the coast around the doldrums, which if you hit it at the right time, wouldn't you get the difference in cooling between the land and the...
Right.
So you should be able to get some wind.
And so that also goes along with how they eat. Because it's like, okay, if they're in the air this much, when are they taking breaks for food and to maintain themselves along the way?
Yep.
And what it was even recorded during Columbus's time, he records about the frigate birds and the boobies being very... in huge flocks around tuna.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever there were tuna migrations, you saw them. Well, wherever you have tuna, you have big upwelling events. So it's kind of cool. These birds are using clouds, but they're also using upwelling areas in order for feeding grounds so that they can continue in their flight.
Cool.
Isn't that neat? They have so many things going for them. It's just amazing. So that's all that I have. There's also, you know, an end note where they talk about, hey, you know, if their feeding patterns and that are really dependent on these upwelling events, that as we have climate change, these upwelling events are less predictable and may really impact organisms that are dependent on certain patterns that have been there forever.
Yeah.
So that's all that I have, but fun stuff.
Yeah.
So, future plans?
Future plans and things we've been doing. Mm-hmm. So I want to make a comment about what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
School ended.
Right.
And that was meant to be a little bit of a release for us because ARDF.
Right.
Which it did, sort of. And one idea was like I could finish building the 80-meter transmitters and get the 2-meter ones going. And the 2-meter has been just a nightmare. It's just, I cannot, and I figured, right, just reprogram the SI-5351 and then start working on the power chain, which will have to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such a higher frequency. And I cannot get... So I can get the SI-5351 going. I finally got it going at 144 megahertz using the Arduino. But that's a different library.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I can get it... I haven't been able to get it up that high with the library I have for straight AVR, which is what we have in our transmitters. So that's, I don't know, just got a nice email from Charles Charlo today, who's a local guy we know through orienteering, and he offered to help out. And so that's one possibility. Maybe he'll know something that I don't. And then we're looking at some other 2-meter transmitters that people are currently putting together now. There's a guy in Kentucky, I think.
Right.
Brian DeYoung, he's working on one, I know, which will be, sounds like it's going to be really fancy. But yes, that's really being slow, and it probably won't happen until next year. No, I'm not sure.
Right.
So with that going really slow, I've done something that I haven't done for a long time, but I took some time off to just do a bit of studying of stuff. And I mean, you remember I was here in bed in the evening and I started to look at, so I looked at logarithmic functions and polar coordinates and the other one was orbits of using, like, orbits of functions where you feed the output of a function back into itself and see what happens over time. And it, I have to say, I hadn't done this now in a couple years because we've been working so hard at getting the transmitter stuff going, and it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, that's, you're even going to bring it to Bear Island.
I think I might.
He's rigging up a way to bring it to Bear Island so well, that he I doesn't might bring a big...
No, I might bring paper. Oh, well. I haven't decided yet.
Yeah.
But, so, yeah, so that's what's been happening. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that we don't have the Island CT stuff all up to date is just because we took a bit of a break.
We did.
Trying, and I've been trying at the same time to get the 2-meter guidance.
Yeah. And so while you've been studying math, I've been doing little workshops and online course. And so I'm going to do a citizen science project next year with eMAML. And so I am going to set up field cameras with the kids and we're going to share data with researchers at the...
You just got a note that you were getting the cameras just like, was it yesterday?
Yeah, I have to respond to it. But since it's a long weekend.
I'm really curious to see how that'll work.
Well, I'm going to, they said, when do you want to come pick it up? And I was going to say, now, so that I can set it up in our backyard when we're gone. Because once it's set up, you don't touch
it. You leave it, right.
For 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, maybe I'll just clear an area in our backyard, set it up.
Because we have deer all the time that sleep just out by our window.
Yeah, and we can't be in, it can't be in the way we walk, but it's, you know, 50-foot area, we're good. We can totally find that. So I thought it would be interesting to do, so I might contact her and try to pick it up next week to install it and have one run before the kids come so it's all debugged. So.
Plans?
Plans, Bear Island, that's it.
Well, Farsta tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So, and Omi and our son Isaac is going to go. So that'll be fun. Never done a Farsta before.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. It'll be neat to see.
Bear Island, we have to pack today.
Yeah.
Because I'm still working.
I've been pretty lazy. I've been laying around reading.
Yeah. That's okay.
And
I think then we have an Ardiff meet.
Yeah.
In August. Which was not our idea.
Nope.
You know, someone else was like, hey, let's do it. I know. It's like, okay. No. Okay, let's do it. So, but I don't know. I'm excited for it. Mm-hmm. And then the 2-meter transmitter, try to find that out. But that's, I think, all our plans until school starts up again.
Right.
So Bear Island is going to be really... Oh, and our next podcast will be recorded...
On Bear Island.
On Bear Island, like it was last year.
Yeah. So very nice.
That will be fun.
Yep. Okay, I think it is time to wrap up.
Okay, let me find my notes. Okay, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.